Pull up a chair. I want to tell you about an airplane that probably taught your grandfather to fly. Maybe your father, maybe you. And here's the strange part. It was never supposed to be famous. Nobody at the factory thought they were building a legend. They thought they were building something cheap enough that a farm kid with a little money in his pocket could learn to fly on a Sunday afternoon. This is Radio Hangar. I'm Tail Dragger, and this is the hangar. And today we're talking about the little yellow airplane, the Piper J3 Cub. Now before I get rolling, let me tell you who keeps the lights on around here. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com, aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up, if you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. And I'll tell you, if there was ever an airplane worth a challenge coin, it's the one we're talking about today, because more first solos happened in a Cub than in just about anything else ever built. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. So, let's set the scene. It's the middle 1930s. The country is flat on its back in the Great Depression. Money is scarce, work is scarce, and the idea that an ordinary person could own and fly an airplane sounds like a rich man's fantasy. Aviation up to that point mostly was a rich man's game or a daredevil's game. Open cockpit biplanes, barnstormers. Military surplus jennies held together with baling wire and nerve. And into that picture comes a little company up in Bradford, Pennsylvania. It started life as the Taylor Aircraft Company, run by a fellow named C.G. Taylor, and there was an oilman on the board, a quiet, penny-pinching businessman named William Piper. Bill Piper had put a little money into the company almost as a lark. He didn't fly, he wasn't an aviation romantic, he was an oil and gas man who understood one thing better than anybody in that building. He understood the customer. Now here's where it gets interesting. Taylor and Piper had this earlier design, the E2 Cub, and the story goes that the name came about almost by accident. An engineer looking at the little Taylor Cub said the thing needed a name. And since a competitor had a design called the Bearcat, somebody said, well, this little thing next to it is just a cub, and it stuck. The cub, a baby. Something small and new and a little bit clumsy that was going to grow into something. The early Cubs were rough, underpowered. The engines were the real problem. 20, 30, 37 horsepower. You have to understand an engine in those days was a temperamental thing. You'd have a Cub with a little Continental or a Zeckley up front, and getting the whole family of little engines to run reliably was half the battle. Then in 1938, they got it right. They refined the design into the airplane that would become immortal, the J3 Cub, and they hung a proper engine on the nose. A Continental A65, 65 horsepower. Let me say that again so it lands. 65 horsepower. That's less than a lot of riding lawnmowers you'll see at a fly-in today. That's the whole airplane. Two seats, one behind the other. A stick, a throttle, and about as much power as a modern motorcycle, and it was perfect. Picture the airplane, because if you've never stood next to one, you're missing something. It's small. Steel tube fuselage wrapped in fabric. Wooden spars in the wing, aluminum ribs, all of it covered in cotton fabric that's been doped tight as a drum and painted that unmistakable color. Cub yellow, Lock Haven yellow, some folks call it. After the town in Pennsylvania where Piper eventually moved the factory. A deep, warm butterscotch yellow with a black lightning stripe running down the side. You can spot it from a half mile away on a grass field. There has never been a more recognizable paint job in all of aviation. Now climb inside. And I mean climb. Because the Cub is a tail dragger, sitting nose high on the ground, and you swing a leg over and settle into that back seat. Because here's a quirk that surprises everybody. You fly the J3 Cub solo from the back seat, not the front. The weight and balance works out that way with just one person aboard. So you're sitting back there, and the panel in front of you is almost a joke by today's standards. Airspeed altimeter, a tachometer, maybe an oil pressure gauge and an oil temperature gauge, a compass sloshing away up on top. That's it. No electrical system on most of them. No radio, no starter, no lights, no gyros. You want to know your fuel? There's a wire that sticks up out of the fuel cap right in front of the windshield, with a cork float on the bottom of it inside the tank. Full tank, the wire stands up tall. As you burn fuel, the wire sinks down. That's your fuel gauge, a bent piece of wire and a cork, bobbing in the slipstream right where you can see it. Simple, honest, it never lied to you. And that little door, the Cub has a split door on the right side. The bottom half folds down, the top half swings up and latches under the wing. And on a warm summer evening, you fly with that whole door open, your elbow hanging out in the breeze, the world sliding by at 65, 70 miles an hour just off your shoulder, the smell of cut grass and warm engine oil and dope coming up off the fabric. The wind, the sound of that little continental up front going put 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 put, that, my friends, is what flying is supposed to feel like. I'll fight anybody who says different. Now, how do you start it? There's no starter. You hand prop it. One person, or better yet, two, one at the controls, and somebody standing out front who swings that propeller through by hand. Contact, and that little four-cylinder catches and settles into a lope. Every cub pilot of a certain generation learned the ritual, the calls, where to put your feet, how to step back and away. It taught you respect for a propeller in a way no checklist ever will. Here's the thing about 65 horsepower. It makes you a better pilot. It has to. You cannot bully a cub. You cannot power your way out of a bad decision, because there isn't any power to spare. You have to fly it. You have to feel the airplane, work the rudder with your feet, respect the wind, and learn to land on that narrow gear with the tail hanging out behind you where it can bite you if you get lazy. The cub does not have brakes worth mentioning. It does not tolerate a sloppy foot on the rudder. It rewards a light touch, and it punishes a heavy hand. There's an old line about the cub, and it's just about the finest compliment you can pay an airplane. They say the Piper Cub is the safest airplane in the world. It can just barely kill you. Chew on that for a second. What it means is the cub flies so slow, so gentle, so forgiving, that when things go wrong, they go wrong, slowly and quietly, and usually you walk away. It stalls at somewhere around 38 miles an hour. You can land it in a couple hundred feet. You can put it down in a farmer's field on a sandbar, on a gravel road. And folks did every single day. And America bought them by the thousands. Piper figured out how to build them on an assembly line, moving down the floor of that plant in Lock Haven. And the price came down and down until a brand new Cub cost right around $1,000. That was the magic number. $1,000 for a brand new airplane. There was a government program before the war, the Civilian Pilot Training Program. And the Cub became the airplane of that program. Colleges and little flight schools all over the country, teaching farm boys and college kids to fly. And they were doing it in yellow Cubs, by some counts. Three out of every four American pilots who earned their wings in that era first went up in a Cub. Piper liked to say that most of America learned to fly in a Cub, and honestly, they weren't far off. Now here's where the story turns, and turns hard, because then came the war. When the United States went to war in 1941, the Army looked at this humble little yellow trainer and saw something. Not a fighter, not a bomber, something quieter and in its own way, just as important. They saw a set of eyes. They painted the Cub olive drab, slapped a star on the side, and gave it a new name, the L-4 Grasshopper. And the Army sent it to war. Think about what that airplane did. No armor, no guns, most of the time, though some crews rigged up bazookas under the wings, and I'll get to that. Just a fabric-covered 65-horsepower Cub flown low and slow over the battlefield by a pilot and an observer. Their job was to loiter above the front lines, spot enemy artillery and troop movements and radio corrections back down to the American guns. They were the eyes of the artillery. They flew off dirt strips carved out of French farmland. They flew off roads. Famously, they even flew off ships. They rigged little wooden flight decks on top of tank landing ships, so short that a Cub could just barely stagger off the front end, and they used those to launch the Grasshoppers for the invasion of southern France and North Africa. They called that contraption a Brody system in some cases, and in others they just built a runway on a boat and hoped for the best. And here's the part that gets me. The scene. Picture the invasion of Normandy, the days after D-Day. The sky full of fighters and bombers, the Thunderbolts and the Mustangs screaming overhead and down low, just above the hedgerows, chugging along at 70 miles an hour with the door open, is a little Piper Cub. Painted olive drab, but a Cub all the same, loitering, watching. Directing the fire of the big guns, the German artillery crews learned to fear that little airplane more than the fighters, because when the Grasshopper showed up overhead, they knew that in a matter of minutes, a rain of American shells was going to come down right on their heads. They'd stop shooting and hide just to keep from being spotted, a 65-horsepower trainer, and it could silence a battery of guns just by showing up. Now here's the story I promised you. There was a pilot named Charles Carpenter. Everybody called him Bazooka Charlie. He was a school teacher from Illinois before the war, and he flew an L-4 he named Rosie the Rocketer. And Charlie decided that spotting for the artillery wasn't quite enough for him, so he bolted six bazooka rocket tubes onto the wing struts of his Cub, three under each wing, and this school teacher in a fabric-covered flying lawnmower went hunting German tanks, tanks with a Piper Cub. And the incredible thing is it worked. He's credited with knocking out several German armored vehicles, including, by the accounts of the time, a couple of the big ones. A man in a Cub diving on tanks, firing rockets off the wing struts of an airplane that Piper built so a farm kid could go for a Sunday flight. You can't make that up. You couldn't sell it as fiction. Nobody would believe you. And there's one more moment I have to give you because it might be the most cub thing that ever happened. When the war in Europe ended, in the chaos of those final days, an American cub pilot spotted a German observation plane, a Fiesler Storch, on the ground. Two American L-4 pilots went after it, and armed with nothing but the pistols they carried, they fired their sidearms out the open doors of their Cubs and forced the German airplane to land. Two guys in Piper Cubs, with handguns, capturing an enemy aircraft in flight. It may be the only air-to-air victory in history scored with a service pistol out the window of a trainer. That's the Cub. That was always the Cub, underestimated, overlooked, and quietly there for every important moment. And when the war was over, the grasshoppers came home. A lot of them got that olive drab paint stripped right back off and went straight back to being flight school trainers and Sunday flyers. Whole generations of pilots after the war got their start the same way their fathers did. In a yellow Cub, off a grass strip, with a door open. Piper built something like 19 or 20,000 of the J-3 and its military brothers before production ended around 1947. And here's the thing that ought to tell you everything. A huge number of them are still flying, right now. Today, there are Cubs out there that are 80 years old and still going up on a calm evening, still landing on the grass, still teaching somebody to fly. The design was so right, so honest, so perfectly matched to what an airplane ought to be, that it never really needed to be improved on. It just needed to be taken care of. You go to any backcountry strip, any grass field, any fly-in breakfast in America, and I promise you'll find one. That yellow, that black lightning bolt, that put of a little Continental, and there'll be a crowd of gray-haired pilots standing around it, and every single one of them will have a story that starts with, "My first airplane was a Cub." Back when Avgis was cheap and airspace was free, the Cub was how you got in. It asked so little of you, $1,000, a grass field, and the willingness to actually learn to fly, and in return it gave you the whole sky. You know, we build these marvelous machines now, glass panels, autopilots, airplanes that'll practically land themselves, and I'm not against any of it. But I'll tell you what worries me a little. I worry we're forgetting what that little yellow airplane knew in its bones, that flying at its heart is a simple thing. Stick, rudder, throttle, and the wind, a cork bobbing on a wire, a door open to the summer evening. The Cub knew that, and every pilot it ever made was better for having learned it. The history on this one draws from Piper's own company records, the accounts collected by the folks at the aviation museums who keep these airplanes flying, and the wartime histories of the L-4 and pilots like Charles Carpenter that the warbird community has worked so hard to preserve. If you want to see the pictures, and you should, there's more over at radiohangar.com.
So the next time you see that flash of yellow taxiing in across the grass, tip your hat to it. It taught your grandfather. It went to war and came home. And it's still out there, putting along, teaching somebody's grandkid the very same thing. This is Taildragger. Keep the greasy side down. And I'll see you back here in the hangar.